But you might have to develop a skill set that you were not taught and trained in the home that you were growing up in. Thanks for being here. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We're continuing our series, Finding God in Life's Biggest Moments. And so far we have looked at the big moments of birth, both this natural birth and the birth of children. We've looked at the new birth, that new birth we have in the second birth, the new birth that we have in Jesus Christ. And then today we're going to be looking at another big life moment, which is marriage. And this is going to apply whether you're married or not, because the really first question you have that's asked and answered for yourself is, should I get married at all? Now there's all sorts of statistics on marriage, but they all kind of agree on the same thing, and that is that in the past, it was just kind of a given that to be an adult member of society and community, you got married, you had kids. But today, that's just not the same anymore. Going back as far as 1960, 75% of adults were married. Today, that number is more at 50%. And you've got 1/4 of millennials that stay unmarried through their 40s, with 25% of them never marrying at all. That is the highest proportion of any modern day generation that has been. And there are some people who want to be married and aren't married, not by choice of their own. But in general, there are three primary reasons why marriages never begin. Number one is economics. There's this belief that you have to be financially stable, you have to have a solid career, you need to have a really good savings, maybe even an investment portfolio, and your potential partner needs to have the same thing as well. And there's wisdom to be had in finances. You need to be a responsible adult. But the assumption is that marriage is this great big drain on you financially, especially after children come, and the tradition and statistics both kind of push back on that belief and that notion. Because traditionally, you got married not because you were financially stable and secure, but to become financially stable and secure. Marriage brings with it a whole lot of economic benefits. Typically, married couples have more. There's more savings. They have more benefits in that, and they save more than singles do. Spouses encourage one another to greater levels of self-discipline than friends ever will encourage you. The second barrier to marriage is individualism. In times past, personal identity was worked out in relationship. You figured out who you were in relationship with your family, with your culture, with your community, and especially in your relationship with God. And you grew because of those relationships. And in modern times, that's turned very inward. It's kind of like what Pastor Blake was talking about with church this morning. Today, it's more who I am is determined by what I think of me, my deepest desires, my feelings. And once I determine what those are, then I will enter into relationships, but only with those people that accept me just as I am on my terms. And we're just bombarded with that mentality in our culture today. And therefore, the key to a satisfying relationship is finding a perfectly compatible person. The phrase, I hate my soulmate. That's someone who is going to affirm me and then who's going to release me just to be able to be myself. And at one time, marriage used to be about subordinating me to us, to the relationship. It even used to be about subordinating me to myself, to my own interests, to my ill-advised self-gratification for the greater good of me, so that I would grow my long-term character development. But today, marriage is all about me. There was this New York Times post written several years ago, it's even more true today, on the subject of happy marriages, and it said this: the notion that the best marriages are those that bring satisfaction to the individual may seem counterintuitive. After all, isn't marriage supposed to be about putting the relationship first? Not anymore. For centuries, marriage was viewed as an economic and social institution, and the emotional and intellectual needs of the spouses were secondary to the survival of the marriage itself. But in modern relationships, people are looking for a partnership. They want partners who make their lives more interesting, who help them attain their valued goals. Therefore, marriage used to be about us, but now it's about me. And here's the irony. If the purpose of marriage isn't so that I have to sacrifice anything, isn't so that I have to change anything about me, then I have to find somebody who is perfectly compatible with me just as I am, someone who affirms me, someone who's going to help me reach my goals, someone with whom I'm going to have this great sexual romantic relationship with. The purpose of marriage becomes personal fulfillment. And if that's not what's in it for me, then I'm not doing it. And if I'm in a marriage where I'm not getting that, or I'm not getting it like I used to, that's not happening anymore, then I'm out. But here's the problem. This approach puts more pressure on marriage than the Bible ever has, or that even cultural tradition ever has. I mean, think about who you have to find in order to have a me marriage. You have to find a person that doesn't think there's a single thing wrong with you, and that you don't think there's anything wrong with them because you don't want to change. It also means that, you know, you're not going to find anything to have to change about them. There shouldn't be, you know, a great deal of conflict, because that means there would be something that needed changing or fixing. There should always be just enjoyable sex whenever I want it. And then if you try to be, you know, real virtuous and religious on top of that and say, well, I'm only looking for a mate that's a Christian, it's impossible. You know, you've got a perspective on marriage that is impossible to be filled. And then if you think you've done that, if you think you've checked off all those boxes and you enter into a marriage and then it's not what you expected it to be, then you say, well, I just married the wrong person. You've established an impossible perspective that can't be fulfilled. And you know why? Because we're all sinners. We are all sinners. And as sinners, we are by nature self-centered people. And when two self-centered people try to have a relationship with one another, there's going to be conflict because there's different self-interests. There's going to be issues that you need to work out. There needs things that you need to change. There's going to be sacrifices that you need to make. And there's also going to be growth. There's going to be great joy in the journey. Here's a great quote that I saw here. It says, for marriage being the incredible thing that it is, you're not the same person after you've entered it. And I kind of think parenthood's a lot the same way. In my life, marriage and parenting brought two of the most catalytic changes in my character, all for the good, because I had to adapt and adjust to these people that I was in relationship with. Social scientists have proven that marriage just brings a multitude of benefits into your life, economically as well as psychologically. Married people, they say, according to studies, tend to be happier. They tend to be healthier. Children tend to fare better when raised in families of married parents. But with that said, does that mean everybody has to be married? No, absolutely not. Jesus wasn't married. Paul wasn't married, but neither does it support this notion that marriage is going to just drain me financially and drain me of any of my individualism. And it's just not the case. Another thing that keeps many from marriage is fear of failure. You know, if you come from a home where an unhappy marriage was the example, or a home that was a divorced home, it's not uncommon for you to think, well, the same thing could happen to me. I've been through that experience once as a kid. I'm not going through it as an adult. So you avoid marriage. Or what oftentimes will happen too is you end up marrying somebody that fits the same pattern that you were used to in that dysfunctional home. You know, for example, if you're this guy who had a very controlling mother, you tend to migrate to controlling women. You know, and if you're a woman who had a dad who was not engaged with the family, you know, not engaged in taking them to church and other things like that, you tend to migrate to a guy who is very familiar in that way. Now, thankfully, Research shows that just the opposite is true in most cases. Exposure to a bad marriage gives you the motivation to build a good one. Now, that was true in my case. By the time I was in sixth grade, my dad had moved on to another woman. My parents were divorced, and I was determined that that was not going to be my future. I just devoured every kind of book imaginable on marriage. I studied other couples, you know, kind of watched them discreetly of things that I saw in their marriage that I liked, that I could emulate. You know, and Tim's parents were a little uncertain of his choice of me because I was coming from a divorced home. You know, joke's on them. I'm still here, still around. But I did not want to be that person who made a vow to Tim, made a covenant before God, and then did not keep my word, didn't fulfill it. So their bad marriage motivated me to have a good one. Now, sometimes divorce is necessary, and the Bible makes allowances. But here's a really sobering fact. They've studied marriages over long periods of time that show that two-thirds, now if you're not good with your fractions, that's more than half of unhappy couples, had they stuck it through, they would have been happy within 5 years. Sobering. So, there are six important factors to consider when building a healthy marriage. Number one, never go to bed angry. If you've been in church, you've heard this one. It's more than just a cliche. It's more than just a verse. There's strong biblical medical reasons behind this saying. It's found in Ephesians 4, 26, and it says, be angry and yet do not sin. Now, I'll stop right there. We've done so many series on the subject of anger, but I want to remind you again, anger is not a sin. It is an emotion that God created within you to experience. The point is, don't use that emotion to sin. And then it goes on to say, do not let the sun go down on your anger and do not give the devil an opportunity. If you're just avoiding these negative feelings, you're avoiding your anger, you're stuffing things down, you're pretending nothing's wrong, you're counterproductive to a happy marriage and you're not helping anybody, and not just a marriage, any relationship. You aren't doing anybody any favors, but you might have to develop a skill set that you were not taught and trained in the home that you were growing up in. I did not get that. My family was a be quiet, don't talk about it, ignore it, pretend it goes away and move on, you know, until it happens again. And then you do that same cycle. So you have to do some things. You got to train yourself, be able to express what is bothering you truthfully without attacking. You need to be able to learn to sincerely repent without excusing your behavior. But at the same time, you need to also make sure you aren't just self-shaming. Oh, you know, I'm terrible. I couldn't, you know, I'm so sorry. That you make the other person finally go, you know, I'm sorry I ever brought it up. You need to learn how to give and receive forgiveness. All these things we've talked about in the past, so I'm not going to go into great detail, but here's a cool thing. Here's a medical side that sheds a whole new light to this biblical verse. In medical circles, it is believed that sleep is the time when what you learned and what you experienced during the day becomes organized into memories and into habits. And going to bed angry nourishes an attitude of resentment. And repeat it often enough, you're going to develop a very deep anger and even a hatred. So God saying don't go to bed angry is a benefit for you, and there's a reason for that. But how do you avoid that? Next one, number two, pray together as your last words of the day. You know, it's really hard to pray angry. You can do it, but it's kind of hard. And I know for some couples where that's not your habit, it can feel very awkward, but all just hold hands or stand together if you're that ticked off. But honestly, if you will just take a few moments and pray over your family, pray over your kids, ask God's blessing over your kids. As you just spend a few moments just praying together, that anger will begin to dissipate like air coming out of an overinflated tire. As you pray together, God's presence will shift your focus. Number six, give each other sex often. All throughout the Bible, our relationship with God is paralleled with that of a marriage, of a bride and a groom. And worship is an act of intimacy. Worship to God is an act of intimacy that builds and strengthens your relationship with God. But you know what? Sometimes you feel like worshiping and sometimes you don't. But you bring yourself to do it because you know that the love and the commitment to the relationship motivates you to draw closer to God and worship. But you know what never, ever happens? God never forces you to worship, ever. And sex is very similar in marriage. Sexual energy is going to rise and fall like any other energy in your body and in your life. And when you're tired, it's super easy to put that off. But like worship, it should never be forced either. But a lack of intimate touching in a marriage can lead to a distance between the two of you. And that word give is put there intentionally because sometimes one person is more interested than another. And so that act of intimacy becomes a gift to them, much like scripture talks about that sacrifice of praise. Next, number four, make deliberate decisions about family, life, and traditions. My goodness, this is a biggie. You can have small things in this area that can cause huge strife and conflict in your marriage and in your home. You each grew up watching mom and dad fulfill certain roles, grandma, grandpa fulfilling certain roles, the family as a unit behaving in a certain way. You know, the husband's always the one that he should be doing. It's his responsibility to, well, the wife should always do this. Holidays, they should always be spent this way. Vacations should be taken and done this way. And assumptions that are going to get you in deep, deep trouble if you do not allow your traditions to be examined and discussed and decided upon as a couple how you're going to do things. And mother-in-law and father-in-law, you need to stay out of that discussion. That is, you had your time, you had your place. Let your kids and their spouses and their families determine what their family traditions are going to be. And as you do that, you're going to be welcomed in a whole lot more than if you put your foot and your mouth in at the onset. And that's all I'm going to say. All right. Let me see where I am. Oh, do we open Christmas presents Christmas Eve or Christmas morning? I mean, after all, there's only one right way to do that, right? What's mealtime going to be like? Is the TV going to be on? Is the TV going to be off? Are we going to eat together? Are we going to eat separate? Who's going to do the cooking? Who's going to change the diapers? Who's going to pay the bills? Who's going to do the yard work? 100 million things that keep a family functioning that you need to examine and discuss for yourselves instead of just coming into that marriage relationship assuming my family did it this way and therefore this is the right way because you both had two completely different experiences. You didn't grow up the same. Number five, learn each other's love languages. Again, this is another huge one. There's two very popular books. One of them is much older, so not as well known. How Do You Say I Love You by Judson Swihart, followed by the more well-known book by Gary Chapman, The Five Love Languages, that both explore the different ways that we as human beings receive love, express love, understand love, such as quality time, words of affirmation, physical touch, acts of service, and giving of gifts. We don't all speak the same love language. And you tend to speak the language that you understand the best. Just like if you were an English-speaking person, you're going to be prone to speak that language. And by golly, 9 times out of 10, you marry somebody with a total different love language than you are. So you need to invest the time to understand what these languages are, become fluent in the language of the person you are loving. It could be your spouse, could be your children, could be your brother, your sister. It applies to any kind of a relationship. We've done series, maybe even more than once in here, so you can go through our archives and listen to the series. You can get the book from the library, audiobook, but take the time to become familiar with love languages and how to apply them in your relationships. And the number six, got the most time on this one. It's mind the gap. Mind the gap. Paul wrote this letter to the church in Corinth. And if you were a kid growing up in Sunday school and I said 1 Corinthians chapter 13, you automatically know what that chapter is about. It is the love chapter. It's a chapter that demonstrates that love is not just some inward feeling I have. Love is an outward horizontal expression that's displayed. And in this chapter, you hear, you know, read at weddings and everywhere where we're told and we're admonished to reminding us that love is patient, love is kind, you know, love it doesn't envy, it doesn't boast. I don't have time to read the whole chapter, but all of these things depend on the lover, the one doing the loving, and not the lovee, the the one receiving the loving. But there's this sentence amongst all of those that is the secret to a happy marriage that has more to do with one than the other, as the other ones do. It has more to do about the person doing the loving than the lovey. The sentence is the secret to the happy marriage is this, 1 Corinthians 13:7. It is love, always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Now, other translations that are a little more close to the original wording replace the word trust with believe, always believes, or believes all things. When in doubt, love defaults to believing and trusting. And that can sound really naive, especially if life has dealt you circumstances that you have protected yourself to not be trusting. But I can protect, I can hope. Those are things that I can do. I can persevere. Those are the things that's mentioned in that verse. But trusting, I'm holding that one back because that one's going to depend on your behavior, whether or not I can trust you or not. But you know what? God doesn't tell us to do something without good reason. In every relationship, not just marriage, every relationship, there is a gap between what I expected and what I experienced. You know, he said he was going to do this and he didn't do it. She said she'd be here by this time and she wasn't. They said they would do this and they didn't follow through. And so this creates a gap between what I expected and what I experienced. And we fill that gap every single time. We choose what we're going to fill that gap most of the time without even being aware that we're doing that. We can choose with one of two things. We choose either to believe the best. You know, he said he would do that and he didn't. I really don't know why he didn't, but they didn't show up when they were supposed to. She wasn't here when she said she would be. When expectation and experience don't line up, it creates this gap. Or we could fill it with assuming the worst. Yep, did it again. I knew they would. It's what they always do. It's what I expected. And here's the key. People in happy relationships choose to make it a habit to do what God said, and that is to believe the best, believe all things. And in the moment, it doesn't feel like the best. It feels like disappointment. It can feel like anger. But God tells us to believe the best. And as far as it is up to you, believe the best until you just can't believe the best anymore. 2005, Marcus Buckingham wrote this book called The One Thing You Need to Know. And it's really a book for organizations and businesses about leadership. But he uses an illustration in his book to support his angle he was going at, but it really fits ours really well this morning. They did a 20-year study. So over two decades, they studied happy couples, authentic happy couples, not just people that were married a long time, because you and I both know people can be married a long time and have a really crappy marriage. But these are authentically happy marriages in U.S., Canada, and Europe. And they went in with some assumptions. There were some things that they expected to find. And the primary assumption that they expected to find was that over time, couples just lowered their expectations of one another. You know, he's not as great as I thought he was when I was starry-eyed and in love, so I'm going to lower my expectations so that I'm not disappointed, so that we can remain married. And amazingly enough, they found just the opposite to be true over this 20-year study. Consistently, happy couples rated their spouse higher than they rated themselves. Across the board, in every quality, they gave their partner a higher score than they gave themselves. And what they labeled this as was an upward spiral of love. And here's how it works. This illusion, you know, she's the greatest, he's the greatest, created this conviction. You know, you believe it for so long, you tell yourself for so long, you actually believe it. He really is great. She really is wonderful. And then that, it creates this conviction. Then the conviction leads to security. Because I believe in who you are, I'm secure with you. I can be myself with you. I trust you. And then that security just fostered intimacy. Intimacy is to be fully known and to know fully. And because I trust you so much, because I'm secure with you, I can be myself with you. I can give myself to you. I trust you with everything that I am. And then that intimacy fostered love. And that's physical as well as relational intimacy. You're planting seeds that are going to grow, and you're going to grow what you sow. You're going to grow what you sow. So you know what that love did? It swooped right back up to that top point. That love went right back to that illusion that created the conviction. It created more security. It created more intimacy. It created more love. That's why they called it this upward spiral of love. It went right back up to the beginning. And at the end of the study, here was their recommendation. They said, in a relationship, find the most generous explanation for each other's behavior and believe it. Because when there's a gap between what you expected and what you experienced, you're going to fill that gap with something. So be generous and believe the good. Be generous. You can choose to believe all things, or you can choose to assume the worst. Is this easy? No. Is this Pollyanna thinking? No. There's going to be obstacles to this. Two real quick obstacles. One is what we've experienced. We've got a history with them. They've set me up not to trust them. So sometimes our history gets in the way. He's done it before. He's going to do it again. The other obstacle is that first one, though, is the one we claim the most. It's much easier to blame somebody else than looking at the second obstacle that's often in the way of being able to fill that gap with the best. And that is who we are and what we bring into the equation. You know, you didn't come into any relationship as a blank slate. You've got years and years, some of you a lot of years and years accumulating of hurts and disappointments and insecurities, and a mama or a dad or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or an ex who has hurt you and harmed you, and you have established these layers that become obstacles when you enter into relationships. But we don't look at that one as much. It's a whole lot easier to focus on what they said or what they did than who I am in the relationship. But bottom line, you are choosing what you put into the gap, regardless of your past or regardless of your present experience. You're choosing what to fill in that gap. Now, does that mean we just ignore bad behavior, or no, absolutely not. You have those difficult discussions. You bring these topics up. Not discussing things isn't going to help anybody, but you mind the gap of what you're going to fill in that space between what you've expected and what you've experienced. And here's the beauty and how we find God in this. That is exactly what God does for us. I mean, if you read scripture, or if you even examine your own walk with Christ, you're going to see that God has a very unfaithful bride in us. He's got a very inconsistent friend in us. He's got rebellious and selfish children in us. And yet, you know what he does? He always protects. He always trusts. He always hopes. And he always perseveres. So we got to love like God. We got to love like God. It's not an easy task that we've been commissioned, but it's not impossible, because he never asks us to do something that he won't equip us to fully do. Your time's up, as always. Thanks for being here this morning. Come back next week.